Welcome to On Deadline, a deep dive into a topic from Odyssey's newsrooms across the country. Today, we're diving into a broad-ranging discussion of money. Why does everything cost so dang much? Beef prices are up, housing is astronomical, and if you haven't looked at your summer electric bill yet, you may want to sit down first. Let's kick things off with Lydia Ho, a correspondent for the Fox Business Network, on what's going on with interest rates.
All eyes are certainly on Jerome Powell because of the kind of pressure campaign that he's been under, coming from President Trump and the broader Trump administration. They really want to see a rate cut. But investors that are closely watching this meeting have no expectation for a move on interest rates. Broadly expected that there will be just a pause at this point. But along with that announcement comes a press conference that Jerome Powell hosts. So everyone is going to be parsing every word that he says to figure out maybe there could be an interest rate cut at the next meeting, which comes in just a couple of months.
Wow. I mean, they do really kind of let you – I mean, they don't – why do they even hold a news conference today if they've already kind of signaled that they're not going to do anything? Is that just to ease the market? I mean, do you have any idea why they do it that way?
That's just the way they have traditionally done it. And actually, yeah, there have been some requests for even more transparency around this meeting. You know, the Fed starts their meeting. It's a 2-day meeting. So it started yesterday.
Right.
And all the voting members actually get together and make their decision about what to do with the interest rates. That meeting is behind closed doors. So we don't know what actually is being said until later when minutes from that meeting are published subsequent to this meeting. Folks want more transparency. Well, they want to be able to see that meeting in real time. And if they did something like that, then maybe we wouldn't have a press conference where we hear just from the Fed chair today. We could hear from each one of the voting members, the governors and the regional presidents directly as they're voicing their own concerns. One thing to look out for today as they're announcing this decision is whether there are any dissents from voting members, on this move on interest rates. It would be highly unusual to have a dissent. In other words, there could be some folks that say, you know what? We actually need to cut rates at this moment. It would be unusual, but we actually kind of think that could happen this time because the economy is in a good shape and because interest rates, a lot of people say, are higher than what they should be. So while we expect no move today, keep an eye out for coverage of whether there are any dissenting voters, who they're coming from, and whether maybe those people are jockeying to be the next Fed chair appointed by President Trump next year when Jerome Powell, his term is up.
It seems like, Lydia, that Jay Powell has consistently blamed uncertainty as it relates to tariffs. Now, I understand we have a big deadline coming up on Friday, but it seems like so far, yeah, there's been a little bit of movement, but it seems like it's been a consistently good market. I mean, what's your whole take on this? How can you argue that, the market's been tanking and that's why I can't do it is because of Trump's tariffs?
Right. Oh, my gosh. Such a great point, because at the beginning, when we heard about conversations around tariffs and the rollout of the liberation tariffs, it was a lot of tariff tantrum happening, a lot of doom and gloom and pessimism. But what we've seen now that we are just ending the second quarter of the year, it couldn't be more different. We just got a read on the GDP for the second quarter, actually out just this morning, and it's showing that we are having growth in the economy, so it's not slowing the economy down. We see inflation, maybe it ticked up slightly. It is not the surge in inflation that people warned us about. We're still well below 3%, 2.7% right now. Definitely doing better than we're doing in the prior administration. Jobs are holding up, but there are some questions about the direction of jobs, which adds to the conversation around we should cut interest rates. We need to make capital and liquidity more accessible to businesses so they can continue to make investments and continue hiring. And to your point about the markets, yeah, Wall Street, they're not concerned, it doesn't seem, because we're just seeing record after record. If you've checked your 401k lately, maybe do it because you might be happy about what you see there. But you're right. That's why folks are saying interest rates are too high. And President Trump keeps saying, listen, we need to cut interest rates because we want to bring the rates down in the short term, which would also bring relief down for those longer interest rate issues like mortgages, to your point, Mark, about what you said. He wants homeownership to become more accessible.
Yeah,
for folks.
It's true. Lydia, who is our guest from the Fox Business Network?
Sometimes I wonder when you have You know, a lot of really smart people in the same room or kind of in the same community. Sometimes you kind of fall at risk of groupthink, right? You know, if one person or a group of people are concerned, you're going to get a lot of people concerned. There were some folks out there that were coming on the Fox Business Network that were, you know, really believers in what President Trump and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent were saying we needed to do to right-size the economy and turn us around and encourage investment in the United States. And I always appreciate when folks like Bill Maher kind of acknowledge, hey, you know what? This isn't playing out like I thought it was going to, and give some credit where credit's due. I always find that to be, you know, I respect that and appreciate that.
I agree.
So yesterday, the president announced that he might be making a trip to China. Not only huge implications for a trade deal, but maybe evidence that the EU deal, the British deal, the Japan deal, all of these falling into place. I mean, you see a strategy there that he was kind of isolating China. They're almost going to have to come to the table at some point, right?
Yeah. And you know what? China now is staring down that deadline. The deadline for them is August 12th for a trade deal. Otherwise, President Trump has said, you know what, we're going to go back to Liberation Day tariffs, and no one wants to see, what was it, 145% tariffs on Chinese goods?
Yeah.
We don't want to see that, frankly. We've got to be honest about it. Americans don't want to see that because we do import and need them for so many products, consumer products, and other elements that they're going to have to figure out. We need them for rare earth minerals at this point. You know, President Trump has now, after his meeting with NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang, you know, we've decided we are going to export chips back to them. Why? Because they are a partner in this AI race. You know, they are a competitor, but we got to be honest, they are developing it as well. So we all have to figure out a way to work this out. They just finished, our Treasury Secretary and our trade representative, Jameson Greer, they just finished a two-day meeting with their Chinese counterparts to work out a trade deal. The readout from that meeting is that conversations are ongoing. Slow, but progress is made, they say, but slow progress. You know, they got a lot to talk about. If there is going to be a postponement of the August 12th deadline, Treasury Secretary Bessent said that's up to the president. So we're waiting to see whether that could possibly happen. But, you know, yeah, I mean, China needs us too. Yeah. You know, they are an export economy. If they can't sell to the United States, it's a big question about who's going to buy their stuff. And they need us a lot to buy their stuff.
And if the prices on the shelves aren't high enough, check out More on a New Trend, custom pricing. That's right. More retailers are using AI to change prices in real time, depending on a variety of factors. Here's more on that from Professor Jay Zagorski at Boston University.
Explain how custom pricing works, because something that's individualized sounds good to me, unless they're going to charge me more because I seem to be more interested in the product.
And that's really the idea with custom pricing. Free spending people, you know, they're going to pay a lot more, and people who are very price sensitive, they're probably going to pay a little bit less. And it's a lot like custom clothing, right? We're going to get custom prices. And the problem with this, Holly, is that most of us, for roughly the last 100 years, have been used to set prices. You walk into a store, you go online, and you expect the price you're going to pay is going to be the same that everybody else is going to pay. And with AI models, that assumption is just going out the window.
How do they know how interested I am in a product?
How long, let's assume you're buying online, how long do you linger on a particular page? How long do you refresh? You know, there's a whole bunch of little clues that tell you whether you care or you don't care. How long does it take for you to put something in your basket? Do you just go immediately click on it and immediately put it in your basket and keep going? Wow, that's somebody who probably is willing to pay a little bit more because they didn't spend any time thinking about it. They just bought it and they put it in. Next time you come back, well, let's raise the price on this person because they don't seem to be paying a lot of attention or care what the price is.
Well, that's how I feel when I'm like shopping for flights to Hawaii. I go on one day, it's one price. I go on another day, it's a different price. And if somebody uses a different computer, they get a different price.
And let's talk about computers for a minute. Just by looking at your browser, I can actually tell whether you're going to be price sensitive or not price sensitive. A couple of examples here in my house. My wife uses a Mac. I happen to use a very old PC. I tend to be a little more price sensitive than my wife because I'm kind of an old cheap guy. And she's like, let's not spend. So people who are looking at the type of computer you're using, how old it is, what type of operating system, gives clues into sort of your spending patterns. Not only that, your location. Where do you actually live? San Francisco has some rich neighborhoods and some poor neighborhoods. Your IP address basically suggests where you're living. Are you in a rich part of town or are you in a poor part of town?
Okay, how do I get around this?
So I actually wrote a book called The Power of Cash. The simplest way when dealing with face-to-face merchants is use paper money, right? There's no paper trail. San Francisco is a hotbed for entrepreneurial activity. It's a hotbed for high technology. But there's a downside of all this fintech movement. And the downside of the fintech movement is it creates a huge amount of data on your shopping habits. And if you happen to use paper money, you happen to use cash, you're not providing any AI model with data on your spending. Now, a lot of people who are listening are going to be like, what? I don't actually go to stores, right? I can't even have the opportunity to use paper money. So there's a couple of different ways. One, you could use things like a VPN to change your location. Number two, you could either clear your cache or use some of the private browsing windows to prevent a history from being recorded. And last but not least, even if none of those are actually available to you, when you put something in your basket, don't hit buy immediately. Just wait a little bit. Basically, tell the computer or tell the AI program that you're not going to buy instantaneously. Just hold off just for a little bit. And that will tell them that you're thinking about it. Even if you're not thinking about it, just wait a moment. A quick example, about a week and a half ago, I decided to buy a pair of glasses online. Yes, I do like using cash, and I do like going to face-to-face stores, but the online price was half the price. And I was like, all right, I'll make the exception here. And I had to go find my credit card because I use cash a lot. I didn't have the credit card available. By the time I found my credit card and came back, they were like, whoa, you know, please buy this. We'll give you a third off. And I was like, oh, I didn't understand how basically walking away for a little bit signals to AI models that I need to be enticed to actually buy the product.
It's just like haggling in real life.
Now let's talk about sticker shock at the grocery store. Here's more from KYW News Radio in Philadelphia.
According to the AP poll, 53% of adults in the country consider the cost of groceries to be a major source of stress. That means close to 9 in 10 people are at least somewhat stressed about the prices. Barb stopped by an Acme here in South Philly because the store has a senior discount on Tuesdays. While she says they are comfortable financially, they're very careful with what they put in their cart.
And then there were some things that we didn't buy because they weren't on sale. So, and just the prices of some of the fresh fruits and vegetables are just very, very scary.
And like others, Barb is also buying more store brand items to save a little bit. Now, after groceries, the poll showed that the cost of housing was a source of at least some stress for the majority of people, 74%. Also high on the list of stressors, the amount of money people are making and able to put away, and the cost of health care.
Only 14% of those polled say grocery costs are not a source of stress. Terry talked to us after picking up a few things from the Mariano's near Randolph along the lakefront.
I paid $4.49 for my chopped salad, and I usually pay like $3.49, so I feel like that's a lot.
She tells us her rising grocery bill has her skipping some name brands.
Maybe not in some of the specific food items that I like, but in things like laundry detergent and toilet paper and all of that, I buy the more generic brands.
If you're trying to put some nice steaks or burgers on the grill, you've experienced a special kind of sticker shock. Here's more on that from WWJ News Radio in Detroit.
So we have seen an uptick in retail beef prices here in the U.S. over the past few months. And of course, we know price is determined by both demand and supply. And when we look at beef right now, there's a story kind of on both sides of that coin. So first, on the demand side of things, so we often see kind of going into these summer grilling months an uptick in demand as consumers go out and put more burgers and steaks on their grills. And so we saw that. And a lot of times we see kind of a slumping off of that demand after the 4th of July holiday and then going into Labor Day. But this year we've seen things kind of remain strong. So demand has remained extremely strong for beef throughout the summer months. And part of that could probably be attributed to consumers and kind of their interest in putting a lot of protein on their plates these days. So we've seen just generally very strong demand for protein products as consumers are kind of health conscious and looking to include a product like beef that is high in protein. When we turn and look at more of the supply side of the equation, we do see that there are some things happening there as well. So there's a phenomenon in the U.S. Beef industry called the cattle cycle. So every 8 to 12 years, we see kind of an expansion and a contraction of the U.S. beef cattle inventory. And right now we're on the contraction phase of that. And so since 2019, at kind of the height of our expansion, we've been decreasing the number of beef cows across the U.S. And a lot of that has been driven by droughts in the western and central parts of the U.S. where a lot of the beef cow herds are located. And even though producers have been very efficient in their production and they're still producing at a very high level, it does make it difficult when you don't have as many cows as you had in the past to kind of respond to these high prices. So even though you may want to be producing more animals to be putting into the beef supply chain, if you have a smaller herd, it's difficult to do that. And beyond that, beef production itself has biological lags, right? So even if I make a market, a decision today based on the market and the high prices, we may not see those animals show up in the beef case at the grocery store or on a restaurant plate for 2 to 3 years, right? So it just takes a long time to respond to those market signals. And especially when you're looking at limited beef cow inventory on the home front.
So is all our beef coming from the United States, or are we importing it from any other country?
So we also import. Yeah, so we'll import a lot of like lean trimmings is a main product. So things that are put into hamburger products here in the U.S. And so we will also import as well. We also import live cattle from other areas, and that's also been kind of an area of interest. We've shut down a lot of our imports from Mexico of live cattle, given New World screw worm. And so that has also limited kind of the number of cows we have here to feed out and get into a retail space.
Okay. So when could we expect, you talk about these different cycles we go through, when can you expect prices to come back down? Is there any expectation for that?
So it's very unknown. It really depends on, you know, when producers decide to kind of pull the trigger and start retaining heifers to build up their herds. But even then, it's going to take, like I said, multiple years to increase the number of breeding stock we have in the U.S. herd. And then beyond that, it's also very demand driven. And so at what point does demand pump off, or does it ever, you know? And so that's, there are a lot of unknowns. And so it's hard to tell at this point.
And most of us have only one way to pay for these higher prices, and that's our job. Here's more from WWL's Tommy Tucker on Trump's beef with the latest numbers.
And Mark Hamrick joins us now, Bankrate senior economic analyst. You heard what President Trump had to say about these job numbers. Tell us, for those that don't deal with this information regularly, what these job numbers are, where do they come from, who makes them up? Because we don't know. I mean, we know people hear about these things on the news, and then we stand at the water cooler or the coffee machine and we repeat them. We don't know what the hell we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, the president is wrong in the way that he's describing these numbers as essentially manipulated or made up for political purposes. I guess some of the suspicion, if you want to call it that, arises from the fact that they are revised repeatedly after the initial release. So, for example, on Friday, we had the release of the July jobs report, and in that we had 73,000 jobs added on the month, which was shy of expectations. And as part of the regular review of this data, as more data comes in, coming into federal government, civilian employees, not political employees, civilians who've been there for many, many decades, there were downward revisions for the months of May and June, which subtracted a total of 258,000 jobs. so that the previous months were not what we thought they were. They were much weaker. And there are revisions that are also done, the so-called annual benchmark revisions, that go back and attempt to look at, well, are we measuring what's going on with the job market, the workforce, the economy appropriately? And this is what the people who are professional statisticians have been doing for as long as I've been looking at this. And I've been looking at this for many, many years. And it took until this president of the United States to say that, oh, well, this was a negative jobs report. There must be something wrong with the data, and there must be something wrong with the person who's in charge of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And over the weekend, you saw essentially a chorus of very sharp criticism of the move from industry groups such as the American Statistician Association, the National Association for Business Economics. And these are groups that are comprised of people from private industry, not political people, who are saying we need robust and credible economic data to make decisions of all kinds, whether, let's say, you're running a bank, you're running a radio station, even just trying to manage your own personal finances. Is the economy getting better? Is it getting worse? Is it marching in place? And if we can't trust the data, then we're in a lot of trouble, because at that point, we're flying blind. And at that point, then you don't really know what to trust or what to believe.
See, when it comes to the exact science of this, where does the Bureau of Labor Statistics get their numbers? Because it seems to me to have an exact number on, I don't know how this can be anything but a rough estimate to begin with, and then a guess after that. Am I wrong?
Well, I mean, it's based on survey data. And so surveys are done of individuals, and surveys are done of businesses. And so, for example, the payrolls data that tells us the number of jobs added on the month is based on the survey of businesses. And then on the unemployment rate, that is a survey of households. Are you working? If you were, how much were you working? You know, did you get a pay increase? That kind of thing. And it's done, the initial data draws are conducted by people who work for the Census Bureau, people who have experience on that sort of thing. And then the data is compiled by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So there's some thought that one of the reasons why we're getting larger revisions right now is because the response rates on the surveys have been falling, meaning fewer people are initially replying. And so if you go back a month or so, you'll get more responses over time. And then that's when, if you want to call it the revision or the refinement in the data, comes. And so that's essentially what's going on. And, I will say also, given the fact that most people don't eat and breathe this kind of information, is that there's been a lot of discussion for years now that, like so many things, such as tax collection or tax enforcement through the IRS, the collection of statistical data is not a priority of some members of Congress who are fine with underfunding it. And so it has been said that we need to do a better job of funding the statistical gathering and management. But that hasn't really been coming. And so, much the same as not in my backyard with funding all kinds of things, this has been underfunded. And, with the president seeking to undermine the whole process, it's hard to imagine that gains any momentum to give the agencies the funding that they say they need.
All right. We're talking to Mark Hamrick, Bankrate senior economic analyst. Bankrate, hardly a bastion of liberalism. I think that would be accurate, Mark, wouldn't you?
Well, I think one of the reasons why we're trusted is because we aren't political. We just aim to help people understand what's going on with interest rates and the economy and help them to solve their financial problems.
We'll talk about what these revisions mean to the economy or what it indicates for the economy when we come back. 621 traffic now, WWL. Now, that's President Trump. We're talking to Mark Hamrick, Bankrate senior economic analyst, about what it means with the revision of the jobs report. But when it comes to President Trump and the revision of the jobs report, that's not the way I remember it from last August, because it seems like last August he says that and he had no evidence for this, that Joe Biden's administration was caught fraudulently manipulating job statistics. So you can't have it both ways, can you, Mark?
Well, of course, that's not unusual, the stance of this particular person. Sure. And let me put it this way, Tommy. You know, you and I talk regularly. That's a great blessing for me, and I appreciate it very much. If we thought for a moment that this had been, you know, even a chance of this happening, we would have been shouting it from the highest rooftops. And you can imagine in the polarized political environment, you would have heard more about this, let's say, from members of Congress. They would have perhaps held hearings on it. I'm pretty sure the Democrats are going to hold hearings on this now because, you know, they need to shine a light. Essentially, both parties need to shine a light on the need for credible and robust economic data. But here's the thing, you know, having watched the economy for many, many decades now, you know, we need to know when the economy is performing well. We need to know when it could be at an inflection point. We need to know when it's not performing well. And I'm going to maybe make a bet, not literally, but I'm going to hold on to hope that we'll continue to have credible economic data. But the president has undermined trust in that process, and I'm pretty sure there's going to be a good number of people who are going to follow his lead on this, at which point, you know, we're going to have a problem. But, you know, we need to know, for example, if the economy is softening as it appears that it is right now, and certainly the Federal Reserve, where Jerome Powell is going to be, you know, in office until May of next year. The Fed needs to know what's going on with the economy. And so don't all the consumers and businesses and other stakeholders in this economy, including investors. And so to undermine the credibility of the economic data, or worse, to weaken the ability to produce the numbers would really be unprecedented and really a travesty.
Thank you. And so the effect on the interest rates is likely to be what as a result of this?
Well, so as a result of the apparent weakening of the economy, the chances are rising that the Fed could cut interest rates at the mid-September meeting as the president wants. But it's a little more complicated than that because the Fed needs to also have confidence that inflation is coming down closer to its 2% target. And unfortunately, one of the impacts of tariffs, taxes on imports, as we all know by now, is to raise the costs that are passed along to consumers and to some degree either paid by business or absorbed by business, weighing on their profit margins. And so essentially, if you think of a balancing act here where the Fed is by law supposed to strive for stable prices and maximum employment, right now both of those targets are under attack.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst. Somebody texted in, Trump derangement syndrome strong this morning. You're ridiculous to start this stuff at 6 a.m. Well, all I'm doing is calling out BS because you can't say the same exact thing is odd last year, now it's even. It's up last year, now it's down. It's black last year, now it's white. You can't do that. It's just BS. So I would ask, where is the real Trump derangement syndrome?
Thank you for listening to On Deadline. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.